From August 7th to September 10th, 1888, Jack the Ripper terrorized the Whitechapel district in London's East End. He killed at least five women, mutilated their bodies in a very unusual manner, indicating that the killer had knowledge of human anatomy. Jack the Ripper was never captured, remains one of England's and the world's most famous criminals. In a moment, Daniel Friedman joins us, his latest book with his father, Eugene Friedman, The Strange Case of Dr. Doyle, A Journey into Madness and Mayhem, fiction and nonfiction combined. But we talk about Jack the Ripper next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Daniel Friedman, MD, received his BA from Stony Brook University and his medical degree from St. George's School of Medicine, currently a practicing pediatrician in Floral Park, New York, also is an active member of the Cohen Children's Medical Center, where he sits on the Voluntary Staff Advisory Committee. In addition to being an amateur sleuth, along with his father and co-author of the book we're going to talk about, Eugene Friedman, doctor, he spends his spare time playing the guitar for the Friedman Brothers Band. Daniel, if I knew that, I would have had you bring your guitar on the radio here.
Oh, thank you, George. I would have loved to have done that.
Looking forward to this. And by the way, I'm going to thank you as a parent for the work you do with children, because to me there is nothing more heartbreaking than seeing a child ill with some affliction, and thank God for what you do.
And I'm very fortunate that my patients come to me and trust me, and I get to be a part of their families in times of need.
I'm in St. Louis right now, and we have a phenomenal hospital for children, Children's Hospital. Gosh, they just run kids through there who have suffered from cancer, all kinds of things.
And I love the fact that you're involved. It sounds like you really, you're deeply immersed into your community.
Oh, absolutely. And I not that we're talking about disease and cancer, but how do little kids get cancer, Daniel? My God.
Sometimes it's a hereditary component. Sometimes it's just an unfortunate a virus that can manifest and change. And there's just so many different ways. There's Epstein-Barr virus that can turn into different things, and there are genetic components, and there's so many ways to get it. No one really has a great answer for that one.
Let's move on to your work, of course. The book, The Strange Case of Dr. Doyle, we'll get into that. A lot of people, of course, who know of the Sherlock Holmes stories will know the name. But Jack the Ripper is still an incredible mystery. All kinds of theories and names of possibilities of who were suspects. You have your own. 129 years old, this case. Why doesn't it go away, Daniel? People are fascinated with it.
Jack the Ripper, it was the first worldwide serial killer. It was a name people knew. It evoked fear in anyone who heard the name Jack the Ripper. And especially when you have someone who was able to avoid detection, no matter how many people were on the streets and committees and police forces, he could elude the greatest searches. No one could find him.
And he killed prostitutes. So I guess the rest of the constituency out in London at the time, do they feel safe?
No, they didn't. They were all worried. When he came out on the streets and did these brutal mutilations, it wasn't just that he killed people. Murder was an everyday occurrence in Whitechapel. He was able to, in just a matter of minutes, dissect bodies out in the streets. The streets that were being, passers-by, workmen going to work, people were there. They could see. He was able to avoid anybody's eye. That's what made him so fearful. He was feared. His name was feared.
What got you and your father Eugene interested in the Jack the Ripper story?
That's a great question. What happened is during my medical school years, when I was cooped up in the library, you're in the library. It's 2 a.m. You have nothing else to do. You pull out an article from like JAMA, and these medical articles would be about Conan Doyle's medical school career or his life as a doctor. And I had no idea at the time that he was a doctor, so I decided to read them. I expected them to be about his days making these brilliant diagnoses on his patients, or how he would use like patient cases to kind of craft the Sherlock Holmes stories. But however, they really were nothing like that at all. Each of these articles were like stranger and more bizarre than the next. You know, one was his involvement in the Piltdown Man hoax. Another article was about his unethical methods of exposing the flaws of the world's greatest scientist. One of them I read in, I think it was in JAMA, was about his rushed medical school thesis on syphilis. And then another article, which was a letter to the editor, which called for the for all prostitutes to be locked away in special hospitals to determine if they had syphilis.
Interesting.
So you know, the impression that these articles left on me was that Doyle lacked any kind of remorse. He had this propensity to perpetrate gigantic hoaxes, that he was willing to go out of his way to ambush and embarrass others, including the greatest intellectual minds of his time when he was still only like 29, 30 years old, and that syphilis, this disease, this great imitator, was on his mind. And it really left on me this feeling that something wasn't right with him, and I decided that I wanted to go figure out what it was.
At what point did he start writing about Sherlock Holmes?
He started writing about Sherlock Holmes actually about maybe 8 months before the Jack the Ripper murders, the end of 1887. But it really didn't take off. I mean, no one really, you know, looked at those stories as being anything good. It wasn't until a few more years later.
Was Doyle thought of highly in society at the time?
No. At that point, no one knew who he was. He was an unknown writer. And he was a not very good doctor. He barely could keep his office open.
Ah, okay. So as you began to study him, what were the clues that led you to believe that he might have been Jack the Ripper?
Well, the first thing I started to do was I actually looked through his diaries. I looked through letters he wrote to people. And I was able to, and I read people's biographies of him, too. And there were various facets of Doyle's life. Some he had been born with, and others he had acquired over the years, which kind of served as clues for me when I was writing this book. I mean, I found that some of his natural talents were his strength, his stamina, his athleticism, his natural-born bellicosity, which he really couldn't control. He would just, you know, he would be outside of a theater, and he would see a group of soldiers, and he would push them down. Or he would enter his dorm room and, like, stab a kid with his the little bed shears that keep your blankets from falling off your bed.
Yeah.
That he got in trouble on the first day of school doing that.
Jeez.
Yeah, the first day he got on to, he was a doctor on an Arctic whaler, and his first day on the ship, he actually blackened the ship's gopher, the guy who, like, runs everything around, he blackened his eye on the first day. And
right.
On that same night, he got upset that the other men could go off the boat and get into a fight, and he wasn't allowed to get off. And he actually petitioned the captain to go off the next day so he could get into a fight. That was really a shocker. And among his acquired skills were his surgical techniques, because he was a doctor, his knowledge to perform massive vivisections on dogs, his ability to take the skin off a seal, his knowledge of photography, which people don't even know he did, but he was a master photographer, and his ability to argue his point of view both orally and in print. Some other things I found out later were that he had this meteoric rise in the Freemasons, and he became a third-degree master mason in less than 2 months.
That's fast.
Yeah, that is very fast. And then when he got the degree, you would think he would, like, you know, embrace it. No, he never showed up to any of the meetings, and he basically resigned within 2 years.
And so many people, Daniel, have been fingered as being Jack the Ripper. There's been discussion, of course, that the Queen's royal physician was one, that there was a English cotton merchant, James Maybrick, might have been one, that a Polish immigrant might have been one. Lots of different possibilities. There was even a story that a St. Louis doctor, I'm in St. Louis right now, that a St. Louis doctor, I think his name was Tumblebee or something like that, Tumbletree, that he might have been Jack the Ripper and then came back to St. Louis and died. Why so many possibilities?
Well, I have to admit, the first thing before I started writing this book, I was also under the impression that Jack the Ripper was the Queen's physician, which is the first one you mentioned. And the first thing I can say about that is, I think my opinion of the Queen's physician was based on a made-for-TV movie back in the 80s. I don't know if you saw it, but it starred Michael Caine, and he was Sir William Gull.
Yeah.
And the premise of that movie was, you know, that Gull was the nefarious Jack the Ripper. when I started doing research for my book, I quickly determined that this person, this William Gall, the Queen's physician, couldn't have been the Ripper. He was 72 years old at the time of the murders. He suffered a stroke a few months before and was left paralyzed on his right side. So I was just having this image of this 72-year-old man running, carrying his arm so it wouldn't flap in the wind, trying to, you know, track down, you know, these women that were only in their 40s, and then miraculously subduing them and mutilating them in the streets. He just made no sense. So people love putting, you know, a name on Jack, but you have to find the right person. You have to find the right attributes and the right MO. I mean, I see that they have, you know, James Maybrick. He's a new one on the radar now. Or even Patricia Cromwell has Walter Sickert, this English impressionist. But the MOs have to match up, and that's the problem with a lot of these theories, that they implicate people and they just don't match. You know, for example, they have H.H. Holmes. He's the newest guy on the radar now. And yes, he was a serial killer, but he wasn't the Ripper. His M.O. was completely different from Jack. Mm-hmm. You know, what motivated Mudgett or H.H. Holmes to carry out his evil deeds was financial gain. It wasn't revenge of any sort. And his methods of execution kind of ran the gamut of locking his victims in airtight vaults, poisoning them with gas, and subjecting them to torture. Because this guy loved hearing the screams of his victims.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, the Ripper didn't have that. He didn't allow his victims to scream. And this H.H. Holmes, he would sometimes sell the body parts to medical schools, kind of like the resurrectionist Burke and Hare from Edinburgh.
Yeah.
But the Ripper just left all the body parts at the crime scene. Although he did take half a kidney, and he actually mailed it back to a pathologist to prove that he was the Ripper. But he didn't sell the organ to a medical school.
And he would conduct his murders on the east side of London right out there at night in the streets, right?
Yes, for the first four, exactly. You know, right out in the open. And as I said, these are heavy trafficked streets. I mean, he did one outside of a social club, where there are people right inside. Anybody could have come out the door and just seen him do this murder. But never was, you know, really eyed. No one really saw who he was. You know, people say, oh, I think it was this. I think I saw a face, a guy wearing a red muffler around his neck, or it was a sailor outfit, but really no one saw.
I'm trying to picture Jack the Ripper and the garb of the day. They had long coats, chimney hats, and they kind of looked that way, didn't they?
You know, that's what they have in the pictures of him when they do a caricature or they make a story up. But when you really read what he probably was wearing, it's amazing. He was ID'd wearing a deerstalker hat, the same as Sherlock Holmes wears.
Interesting
which is kind
take.
Of an odd outfit to wear in the middle of the east end of London.
Yeah, you would think that they would spot him a little quicker that
exactly.
way.
Exactly. He wasn't wearing these gentleman top hats, you know. He was wearing, they say, a sailor coat, which a couple of people have witnessed. You know, the eyewitnesses say he wore a sailor coat.
Huh.
So that's why some people thought he was a naval man. But, of course, the deerstalker hat, and they have him with a red muffler around his neck, is kind of just an odd outfit, especially since it was the summertime.
We didn't have DNA, we didn't have smartphones, we didn't have cameras all over the place.
True. It's true. And even fingerprinting didn't get really wasn't put into place until the late 1890s. So even fingerprints weren't going to deter a murderer from doing his deeds.
So now he killed five prostitutes within a month of each other in 1888. Why do you think Jack the Ripper stopped? Or did he?
Well, yeah, he did. I think what happened is that these were acts of revenge. I think that that Jack had an agenda, and he had to carry it out. And once it was fully carried out, he was able to stop and go back into society, just like a regular, everyday, you know, person.
It really is perplexing. And in your book, The Strange Case of Dr. Doyle, you kind of mix nonfiction and fiction, don't you?
Yeah, I do that. And actually, you know, I had to figure out a way to come up with, like, presenting things if I wanted anybody to read the book, because it is nonfiction, and it's a true crime, and then it's a biography. So what happened is I was watching The Godfather 2, which is a great movie, and the movie kind of flashes back to Vito Corleone's earlier life. And the way Coppola directed the film lets moviegoers learn a lot about like this critical period which shaped the future Don's destiny. And I just took that, you know, that technique, and I ran with it with my book. So I initially wrote the book in two separate pieces, like the biography and then the tour section, and kind of like I shuffled them together so that when you read it, you read one part of the tour, and I do it in chronological order. And then the next part becomes Doyle's early life, and then the next murder will come, and then you'll learn a little about Doyle's later life until you get to the end of the book.
Is this your first book?
This is my first book.
And your father wrote some of this with you, right?
Yes, he did. We wrote it together. You know, we kind of spoke about how we wanted the dialogue to sound. We would act it out together to make sure it sounded, you know, not phony.
Well, I bet you two were fun at parties, huh?
Oh, we were great, especially since I had to do a lot of the Ripper lines, and my father did a lot of the lady lines, and we would talk like this a lot, you know?
Yeah. Oh, no, don't.
Exactly.
Yeah. It was an amazing time period during that era. They had newspapers in that era. These were headline stories, were they not?
Not only that, these Ripper cases, these Ripper crimes, the papers were going. They were selling 500,000 copies a day every time a new murder was committed. The papers were loving this, and in fact, you know. The Ripper would, there were letters being sent to the press, there was being sent to other people. So when these letters came in, again, because there were a couple of weeks where the Ripper was kind of inactive on the streets, but there was a letter writing time. And again, the amounts of circulation, you know, skyrocketed again. So this was a great time for the press.
How were most of the women killed, Daniel?
Okay, so murder, I want to do it like in chronological order. So murder number three, which occurred on the last day of September, there were two, but one of them was just like the lady's neck was slit almost off. So her chin was decapitated.
So he used a knife, though.
Yeah, he did. He used a knife. A very sharp one, because he was almost able to cut this lady's head off. The first murder, you actually didn't even know she was mutilated until you lifted up her outfit and you saw he did an abdominal dissection on her.
He knew anatomy.
Oh, he definitely
knew
anatomy.
There's no question about that. And Doyle knew anatomy.
Right. And not only that, Doyle advertised his services as a midwife. He did not do it more as a general practitioner. When he first started out, he was giving out midwifery cards, which is basically obstetrics.
Delivering babies and things like that.
Right. That was how he was. He advertised his services.
Huh.
Of course, Doyle's skills as a surgeon were made even, you know, faster because of his time in the Arctic. He went up to the Arctic as a ship's physician, but when he finished, the captain of the ship invited him back, not as a doctor, but he didn't want him back in that role. He wanted him back as a sealer and a whaler. He was that good at it.
Jeez, hold on. We're going to come back in a moment, Daniel. Dr. Daniel Friedman with us, his work called The Strange Case of Dr. Doyle, as we talk about Jack the Ripper. And welcome back to Coast, Daniel Friedman with us as we talk about Jack the Ripper, The Strange Case of Dr. Doyle. Have other people, Daniel, seem to point at Dr. Doyle as the suspect?
I don't think Arthur Conan Doyle is really one of the top suspects on the list. That's basically my take on it. I think people are really looking at the people that Patricia Cromwell, like Walter Sickert, he's one of the big names, or the Queen's Royal Physician. James Maybrick is coming out there now from his diary, which is amazing, because I don't know if you know the story, but that, and I think it was in the early 1990s, a person found supposedly this diary, and there was all these stories about how did you find it, where did you get it, either it was an heirloom of his wife, or they found it underneath the floorboards, and when Michael Barrett was brought to bring this thing up, he was going to sell it, and then all of a sudden he made an affidavit saying that he and his wife made up the entire thing. So I'm actually looking, I want to get a copy of what the diary is, because in his affidavit he actually says where he gets the information from, like Punch magazine, I think, is one of them, and some of the papers he mentions too. So that's a name that's out there too, but I don't think Doyle's really the one that's going to come out, because people love Arthur Conan Doyle. I mean, I love Arthur Conan Doyle's stories. I love Sherlock Holmes. I mean, it's fantastic. And when you read his other stories, they're just even better. In fact, actually, during the research for this book, I uncovered 15 Arthur Conan Doyle stories written under other names, which will be the subject of my next book.
Excellent. Now, let's get into some of the other possibilities here of Jack the Ripper and see how would you weigh Doyle with them? Even though Doyle's your theory, what about the other ones?
Well, first of all, you need a person who wasn't afraid of confronting the police. A man like Doyle. I mean, he's already been investigated two times before the Ripper crimes, one for a prank against the mayor of Birmingham, where he sent out these invitations to a mayor's ball, had all these people show up, and there was no mayor's ball. And he got caught, and the police, you know, basically came to where he was working and told his employer, you know, you got to get rid of this guy. And another time was for the death of his future wife's brother, where he took in his future wife's brother before he was even engaged to her. He didn't really know her yet. Took him into his house where he was a doctor, and supposedly gave too high a dose of chlorohydrate, and his future brother-in-law, who would have been his future brother-in-law, never woke up again. And he went out of his way to bury him, like, as quick as possible. And, again, the police came to his house, investigated the situation, and he got off the hook only because the real doctor that was in charge of this case said, Noah, I came and saw the patient the night before, and he was doing fine. So that's number one. You need a guy who's able to do that. And the other people obviously would not. You know, as I said before, H.H. Holmes, he did all his stuff indoors. He kept off the streets. And Maybrick, who people are looking at the diary now, he was a poisoner. He didn't go out on the streets and try to confront the police. He hid. So that's number one. The M.O.s have to match up. Also, if you look at Doyle's writings, he's not afraid to poke barbs at the police, especially Scotland Yard. He has his Inspector Lestrade. He's no match for his brilliant Sherlock Holmes, and he makes sure that you know it. And it also, you need a motive to kill. And Doyle had that motive. He actually thought that his father, and probably even himself, was suffering from syphilis, which would have likely been transmitted to his father through the prostitutes of London's East End, you know? And Doyle thought that he was afflicted with it too. And as a matter of fact, Doyle, in his medical school thesis on syphilis, tells people that he was taking high doses of medication that are used only in syphilitic patients. And why else would you be taking that type of medicine in high doses unless you thought you had syphilis? And when Doyle was 10 or 11 years old, he was afflicted with this jaw pain. And again, when he was about in his early 20s, he was working with that doctor that he got caught with the hoax.
Mm-hmm.
And he used a natural remedy, jasmine root, to treat his neuralgia. And he took basically toxic amounts of it. But again, that neuralgia you get could have been the pain of what you get with syphilis. So he really thought he was doomed. He thought he was a doomed man at the time when he was young. And that's like medical school's disease. You go to medical school, you read about a disease, and the next thing you think is that you have that disease or you're going to die. You know, these are the things that go through your head. I went through it too. Every time you read something, you think that you got it, you know?
Was he insane, in your opinion, Daniel? You know, obviously you killed, a number of people. You're insane, but what do you think?
You know, I think he's sociopathic. I think he had a condition which made it that he had to complete his revenge, and once that was out of his system, he was able to go back to society as a great person. I think if he didn't, he had to complete what he had to do. It was something he had to do.
Let's get into now the possibilities of Arthur Conan Doyle being, of course, Jack the Ripper. And when you say he wrote the Sherlock Holmes mysteries, that came after the murders?
The first one actually came a little bit before the murder.
Are there any clues in his writings about Sherlock Holmes that could lead you to him as the Jack the Ripper killer?
Well, you know, first of all, if you're like the Sherlockians might know this, but the people that read Sherlock Holmes will know that about 32% of the stories, the dates, actually occur on the nights of the murders. That's, to me, that was...
That's unbelievable.
Yeah, 32%. Not the years, but the dates, you know. Like, in other words, like tomorrow would be The Adventure of the Cardboard Box, which takes place on tomorrow's date, 1889, on the one-year anniversary.
Now, would this be everybody's knowledge at the time? I mean, he could have said, yeah, I kind of like the fact that, you know, they were killed, so I used it for my dates in my book.
Well, he really didn't ever mention in his Sherlock Holmes stories the Jack the Ripper crimes. That was never in his stories. Although, I think it was 1894, he actually wrote an article for the Portsmouth News, and they got, like, you know, basically put into syndication, where he says how Sherlock Holmes would have solved the Jack the Ripper crimes. And he describes the Dear Boss letter and the penmanship on it, and he goes out of his way to tell you that it would probably have been a midwife, which, by the way, he was a midwife. And he would have been a strong, athletic guy. He's actually and a writer. He says the person that wrote the Jack the Ripper letters must have been a writer. So if you look at what he's telling you who the killer is, he possesses all of the attributes. It's really fascinating. He has a clerkly hand. He describes the paper that the Ripper wrote on him being the fine quality of the paper. And that, going back to the paper, which is really... the best part was that when I was writing the book, my publisher actually told me, you know, this whole thing with Peary Paper and Patricia Cromwell, and if you can't find that, you know, Doyle would have had access to this type of paper, we really can't go on with this book. And it within about a day, I was reading a book that was written by his professor, William Rutherford, and I think it was like page 11, it says that all of my students, which, of course, Doyle was one of his students, have to use this, you know, this Peary paper from Aberdeen, Scotland. It's basically an artist-grade paper, and it has, like, a highly glazed antique shine to it. So I was able to show him this proof that, here you go, you know, this is what Patricia Cromwell went for with this paper quality. And Doyle's textbook that he was reading shows that he was using that type of paper.
What was the oh my God moment where you said to yourself, this guy is Jack the Ripper?
You know, I don't know if there was ever really a smoking gun moment. I mean, everything kind of like started, you know, adding up. You know, he was a Freemason, he was a whaler, he was a sealer, he was a vivisectionist. The operation he performed on the dog, which was opening their abdomens, putting cannulas in their livers and taking out samples and cutting their windpipes open, basically the same type of operation he did on the women that he killed. Or he was a master mason, and one of the rituals they did was exactly the same type of procedure they did with the organs of that's what we did with the organs of his victims. It seemed like everything started to add up. But I guess if there had been like one, you know, piece of evidence that really kind of got me going was a communication I received from Scotland Yard, which was that the Dear Boss letter was the only letter that went missing from the Ripper file, and then they put the other letters away, although they said that all the letters were taken. It was only this one, and it was because the Dear Boss letter was the one that Doyle wrote about in that article in 1894. He was actually in Scotland Yard's Black Museum, and he had access to all of the letters. And it was just so odd that the one that went missing was the one that he was the last on record to see.
If it wasn't Doyle, who do you think it would have been?
If it wasn't Doyle, who could have... There are just so many characters out there that it could be the, you know, could fit the bill. But as far as the ones that I know it can't be, would be like Kaminsky. He was just a 100-pound... anorexic, basically. He could never have tackled these women.
That was the Polish immigrant, right?
Right, exactly. He's 100 pounds. These women were street fighters. They, you know, one of the women was in jail that night of her murder, and another one was in a bar fight a couple of days before with black and blue marks. I mean, these are tough women. You know, you're not going to be 100 pounds and take them on in 3 or 4 minutes and suffocate them and then mutilate them. It's not going to be someone who was afraid to confront the police, you know, to hide and do poisonings and stay inside and want to hear people be tortured. You had to have someone with that kind of, you have to have the MO and you have to have the natural abilities to do something. You know, Doyle, if you look at his writings, he could shimmy up a water pipe with the greatest of ease. You know, he could escape detection just by climbing up a water pipe if he wanted to.
Huh.
And he writes that he...
Pretty agile, I guess.
Yeah. Actually, there's a story that when he was about maybe 19 or 20, he went to Ireland to visit his family members, and in order to play a trick on his relative, he actually climbed up a water pipe to pretend he was a burglar, and his cousin Dick had a barrel gun in his head. You know, he got up. And he said, you know, he could have blown my brains out. So... He writes about this, and he writes about how his father, just like his father, who was in a mental hospital at the time, his father was incarcerated in a mental hospital and when he was 42 years old, and that's where he died. And that's, you know, that would also be like a smoking gun moment for me. When I received information from one of the mental hospitals that Charles Doyle, Arthur Conan Doyle's father, was in, I asked for the medical records, and one of the reports said the only abnormal finding on this man was that he had an absent knee-jerk reflex, which is called the Westfall sign. And the thing was that Doyle, in his medical school thesis, writes about that exact sign and how that if you have that sign, the absent knee-jerk, you know, you take a reflex hammer and you hit someone's knee and it
bounces. Yeah.
Yeah, he said that if you lost that sign, that's your only physical finding, then you have syphilis. And he writes about that in his thesis, and that, of course, was his father's only admission abnormality on physical. So that was also a eureka moment, I guess you would call it.
And did he think he was cleansing the city?
I don't think he thought he was really cleansing the city. I think he was saying, you know, my father is going to be locked away and die in a mental hospital, which he did, and he's there for a reason. He's there because he contracted syphilis probably when he was in London, and he was going to get revenge for him. And not only just for him, if you look at his thesis, he actually probably believed that he had syphilis too. In fact, a little bit later on, he was using medicines that use in photography to treat what he called psoriasis. Now, a lot of people don't know this, but psoriasis, the rash of psoriasis, can actually look like exactly like the rash of syphilis. So in his mind, if he had the jaw pain, if he was treating himself with this medicine that was used for syphilis, and now he has this rash, I'm sure he must have thought he was a goner.
Did Doyle get married? Did he have kids, a family?
Yes, he actually got married twice. He got married to this woman, Tui, which he called her, and he really wasn't in love with her, I guess you would say. He had children, and then when she got tuberculosis and... He stayed with her, but he eventually was supposedly had affairs with this woman, Jean Leakey, and then he married Jean when she passed immediately afterwards. Yeah. And he had kids with both of them. And Jean, I think it was Jean was more his soulmate. She was into the spiritualism, and she was behind this thing they did to Harry Houdini, which was terrible, mm-hmm. which was the two of them took Harry Houdini to Atlantic City, where basically she did a seance with only Houdini. His wife was there. Harry Houdini's wife was there, too. But the Doyle said to the Houdinis, only Harry can go with us. And she proceeded to write down Harry Houdini's mother's thoughts. But the problem was that Houdini knew that when you come back from the other world, you speak in your language. And
that's
that people
right.
that are mediums actually hear the language that the person spoke. And Jean Leakey Doyle was writing down the Queen's English. And Harry Houdini's mother only did not speak that at all.
He knew she was a fraud.
Yeah, so it really upset him, and that's why the relationship kind of ended.
Would you consider him to be a serial killer? He did stop.
I still consider him a serial killer. As a matter of fact, I actually think he did one other murder a little after the Ripper crimes.
I was going to say, because this one-month period of these murders, and then to abruptly stop, something had to have happened.
Right.
Either they got close. I mean, was he ever considered a suspect?
You know, I'm not going to say that he was ever considered a suspect, but I do. I can't verify this, but I've seen it in, you know, when you look up on the internet and you look up in other people's books, that his professor, Bell, who became the model for Sherlock Holmes, wrote a letter supposedly to Scotland Yard saying that he knows the identity of Jack the Ripper, and if the Ripper doesn't stop, he'll turn him in. So, which no one ever put two and two together, that may be that Doyle may have heard word of this also and said, you know, this guy will turn me in if I don't stop.
Interesting take on that. And how did he, in his Sherlock Holmes books, come up with the Watson character?
Well, you know, there was a Dr. Watson in his, a couple times in his life. There was a Watson School of Medicine up in Edinburgh. There was a Dr. Watson in his Freemason organization who traveled the world. He was in China, and he came back to Portsmouth, where he was living at the time. But the name Watson, he's probably heard it multiple times. There's also a Watson in his class in school, a Patrick Watson, I believe, in where he went to Stonyhurst College.
What a great mystery. Where's the book available, Daniel?
The book can be found at, you know, I go to Amazon.com for, you know, when I order books. But then again, I also go to the local bookstore. Barnes & Noble has the book, too. And I think you can actually order from my publisher directly at his number, which is 516-535-2010.
Okay, we're going to come back and take phone calls with you next with Dr. Daniel Friedman. His book is called The Strange Case of Dr. Doyle.